It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for May 29th, 2021. Happy Memorial Day, everyone, and we can truly say this is the start of summer riding here in Northeast Ohio, although looking out the window and walking outside, the weather is apparently saying something different. It's in the 40s and raining. But we can forget about that, and instead, let's get on with our show. We talk about advocacy, safety, trails, and planning a lot, and today we wrap much of that into a conversation with Dave Snyder, the executive director of CalBike, the California Bicycle Coalition. Dave was born to advocacy. I don't mean that as literally as it sounds, but his passion for the work started in college and has never waned. Today, Dave's commitment to safer streets and more people riding is still his focus, and he's killing it with both ideas and action. From the $10 million e-bike affordability program to the Bicycle Tourism Initiative, CalBike is paving the way for more people on bikes, more of the time, safely. And Dave's answers to what is most important to preserve any gains we've made during COVID in terms of more, better, and safe biking are spot on. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. Hello, Dave. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week. How is California?
It's great. It's fire season, but there are no fires yet.
Well, that's a good thing. Yeah. That's really good. So I was privy to a little bit of a conversation you were having before you and I started, because this is another one of those occasions when I get to use Zoom, and I actually was watching what was going on, although I actually couldn't see you, but I could hear what you were talking about. And it seems like you're really, really involved with legislation in California as the director of the California Bicycle Coalition. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, we represent the movement for more and better bicycling in California. We have the responsibility in the legislature to inform legislators about whether or not the bills will make it easier or harder for people to ride bikes. I wish they made all their decisions based on that information, but it definitely influences legislators. And we've stopped a few bad bills in the past, and we've gotten a few good ones passed.
Give me an example of one that you were able to stop that was a bad bill. That's interesting.
I'll give you two.
Okay.
Just last year, there was a bill, a well-meaning bill, to impose an insurance requirement on the companies and agencies that provide shared bikes and scooters. It was in response to the chaos that, you know, came to us a few years ago when all these companies just dropped all these scooters and bikes on the streets, and it was requiring them to get permits and requiring them to follow certain rules, all of which was very reasonable, except for the insurance requirement. The insurance requirement would have made those companies liable for all of the costs of a crash, even if it was caused by the user of the scooter with no fault of the company. So if I rented a scooter and crashed it into somebody and caused or something and caused $1 million worth of damage, the company would have been on the hook for that, even though it was my fault. And to provide insurance for that would have been so expensive that all of those services would have gone out of business. It was just not feasible. And people didn't recognize that threat quickly enough. And the bill was up for a vote on the assembly floor. And people predicted it would pass. And we marshaled city leaders and bike advocates across the state and did this huge instant push. And in a matter of a week, we got enough people asking questions that the author called us and we had a conversation and they dropped that provision from the bill.
So just to play devil's advocate for a moment, and I totally understand that we do not want these companies to be on the hook for millions of dollars when you have a person who is probably irresponsible in some way, wreaking havoc maybe with one of their vehicles. What about the side of the sort of the no fault idea that we have with cars, where a cyclist is hurt on one of these, who, you know, that yes, the car is at fault, but if the car takes off and they can never find him, is there any insurance there?
It depends. A lot of people's car insurance would cover that.
If they found the car. So in Ohio, we have no fault. Somebody smashes into me, guy doesn't have any insurance. My insurance is required to pick that up.
Yeah, and I think we have that in California too. But if you don't have insurance, then you are out of luck. It's a fact. It's a problem that nobody's figured out how to solve. The only proposals have required the agency or company to pay for all the costs.
Yeah, I was just wondering if there was any way of putting that back into that scooter rental or bike rental, and not like it's a good thing. I was just wondering. So that was bill number one. What was the second one?
About 5 years ago, maybe. And it was a bill that would have mandated that everybody wears a safety helmet when they ride a bicycle, no matter what their age or where they're going.
Say no more. I am so against mandated helmet laws.
Yeah, this one had some legs, you know, and it had a lot of support. You know, we have a lot of allies among health organizations, you know, and some of the health organizations understood the challenge to health if you make it harder to ride a bike. But many of them were just looking at, you know, the head injuries that they see in the emergency room, and they supported it. So it was a tough fight. We had to work really hard on that one.
And we know that that's not the only thing that prevents head injury all the time. Yes, I mean, I wouldn't ride without one, but to mandate it tends to not send the right message. Send the right message. Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Dave Snyder. He's the executive director of the California Bicycle Coalition, better known as CalBike. So other than doing all this legislative stuff, what do you do there as the executive director? What kinds of duties do you have?
Well, I have a great team. So my responsibility is to make sure that the folks who are on my team are put in positions to succeed. So, you know, I have a senior policy advocate whose job it is to organize community organizations and cities to support our priority bills. I have a development director whose job it is to raise the money to develop the political power. I have an admin person whose job it is to make sure everything functions smoothly. And my role is to just get the obstacles out of their way and provide support for them however I can. It's different than where I was in the beginning. You know, when I took over this organization a long 10 years ago, it was just me for a minute. And so I had to do all those parts. And to be honest, my staff will tell you I'm having a hard time letting go of some of those parts.
Yeah, I understand that. It's an entrepreneurial kind of position that you take, and it's like, it's mine, it's my baby. This isn't all you've ever done. How did you get into advocacy, and what did you do before?
I tell you, it's mostly what I've done.
Really?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate. I was, as a friend of mine says, who became a very successful, more successful. I'm not going to say that. a friend of mine says that he graduated from his fancy college and wanted to be a transportation activist. And he says, how can I be a transportation activist? That's not a job. And then he saw, hey, wait, there's this guy, Dave Snyder. He's executive director of the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition. He's doing it. Maybe I can. His name is Stuart Cohen. And he went on to lead Transform and do a fantastic job leading that organization. So he and I were the first two professional sustainable transportation advocates in the Bay Area.
Put that into the context of time. When did that?
Yeah. So let me, you asked me earlier to tell the story, and I said it was a kind of an interesting story of how I got started. So I graduated from college in 1988. I got a very progressive education. It was a Christian college, a left-wing Christian college.
Is that an oxymoron?
No.
Okay.
No, just checking. No. Look at Martin Luther King.
That's true.
It was a very internationalist college, and they don't advertise themselves as a left-wing college, mind you. But that was the gist as I understood it because of the classes that I took and the professors that I had. And it instilled in me a desire to change the world, to put it simply. Like, I graduated from college and I considered graduate school, but I didn't want to study more. I wanted to do things. I wanted to apply what I learned, to go out and change things. So I looked in the paper for jobs for activists, and there were a long section of jobs called activists in the classified ads in those days. And what they really were jobs to go door-to-door fundraising. So I worked there for 6 months. I learned how to ask strangers for money, which was a very valuable skill. And I moved to San Francisco after about 6 months. I'm living in San Francisco. I have a job as a secretary, office manager at a foundation that funds peace organizations. I don't have a car because I don't have any money. There's no way I could afford it. You don't really need one in San Francisco. And I'm involved in all these various progressive organizations, and including something called the Media Alliance that was working to improve the press coverage of the wars in Central America. We really focused on the revolutions in El Salvador and Nicaragua, where the United States was supporting the dictators and the democracy movement was resisting, and the media coverage of it was very poor. So I worked with this organization to try to get media coverage to be better. But I didn't even speak Spanish. I'd never been to Central America. It seemed like a good thing to do, but it wasn't the kind of thing that was really authentic to my passions. And on Earth Day 1990, a group of people decided to kind of protest our transportation system's destruction of the Earth with a bicycle parade, a sort of semi-legal parade from one part of the city to another, and talk about the environment. And it was on that ride with all these people whose organizing style I respected a lot that I had an epiphany. I thought, I can be a bike activist. That's what I can do. That way I'm organizing my own people. I'm not organizing, for Central America stuff, which is valuable, but where I don't have any connection, I can organize my own people here in San Francisco. And by making it easier to ride bikes, we will make it easier for people to be healthy. We will reduce America's dependence on oil, which will reduce the chances for oil wars. And we will clean up the environment, which will reduce climate change and all the other threats that we have from automobile-based pollution. I thought, that's what I'll do. It touches all the issues I care about. I'm organizing my own people. I'll be a bike activist. And so from that day on, I decided to do that. I quit my job. I found someone who was able to give me a little grant. I had cheap rent. And I started off kind of putting together a team of folks who wanted to make the city better for bicycling. There was an organization called the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition in name only. Their corporate status had expired, but I asked the holder of the name if I could revive it, and he said sure. And so we revived the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition in 1991, and off we went.
Wow, that's a hell of a story.
Nowadays, the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition has, I don't know, 15 staff people and a multi-million dollar budget.
Yep, you've kind of risen above that with the California.
Yeah, you'd think. You'd think. No, we're a small organization, though. We're a million-dollar organization. That's
interesting that you're saying you're smaller than the San Francisco organization.
Yeah, we're smaller than a number of local organizations because our role is very narrow. It's extremely important, but it's very narrow. Our role is state policy, funding, and legislation. Our role is not community organizing to get a bike lane anywhere. You know, that's the real work. That's what's really going to change our state for bicycling is getting local city councils and mayors to be willing to get rid of parking to put in a protected bike lane, be willing to cause some congestion at an intersection in order to give people on bikes a chance to get through it safely. That's what it's really going to take. And you know, our job isn't to do any of that. Our job is to make it easier for the folks who are doing that to succeed.
So we're going to take a short break. We're talking with Dave Snyder. He is the executive director of CalBike, the California Bicycle Coalition. Before we do, I want to know, do you know Gary Helfert?
I do, yeah.
He's one of the luminaries in our world, the bicycle world. He was just a brilliant guy. All right, we are going to take a short break. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
A bicycle crash is not an accident. And when you find yourself in a situation that calls for experienced, effective, and positive legal support and advocacy, you can depend on any of North America's independent bike law members. Bike Law's cycling attorneys are members of our community committed to the pursuit of cycling safety and justice. For more information about Bike Law, log on to bikelaw.com. They're on your left, protecting your rights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're speaking with Dave Snyder. He is the executive director of CalBike, the California Bicycle Coalition. And when we left off, we were talking about the fact that his organization deals at the state level and that a lot of what he thinks is going to change things is more at the local level, which we talk about that a lot. And I'm sure you work with some urban planners, but you seem to work even on a bigger umbrella than that, like a higher umbrella. So I wanted to ask you about bicycle tourism, because that seems to be under your purview. There's a bicycle tourism initiative. And the other person who's on the show with you this week is a tour director who out of North Carolina, who is offering tours this year, which she couldn't do last year because of COVID. So I wanted to wrap in some of this idea of tourism and how important
it is. Yeah, sure. We are working on tourism now because Caltrans gave us the opportunity with a grant to bring together the transportation agencies of five counties in Central California to figure out what they could do to make their communities safer and more attractive for bicycling in order to attract tourists for economic development. It's as much an economic development initiative as it is a safety initiative. And our not so secret agenda is that by making the streets and roads safer for bicycling for tourists, it makes them safer for the folks who live there and will help them get around in their everyday lives without a car or by using less automobiles. So that's proving to be a successful effort with plenty of challenges. What we've discovered is that the most important things we can do for bicycle tourism are really difficult and expensive. It's paths next to rivers, it's paths next to canals, it's paths on old railroad beds. Those we sort of analyzed our choices of creating those kind of facilities or just widening the roadways to put in nice shoulders, and decided that creating separate facilities was the better way to go.
So that brings me to some of the things that are going on in Washington and how tied in to bicycle and pedestrian initiatives Cal Bike might be, and if they're going to be, do you see any federal funding coming your way for those kinds of paths and bikeways that are separate?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the Congress has reinstituted something that had been considered bad government, and that is earmarks, where a representative is allowed to insert into a federal bill money for a project back home, and everybody gets a little earmark, separate from the regular competitive funding process that the U.S. Department of Transportation will run. And those earmarks have proven to be disproportionately in support of bicycling and walking infrastructure, bicycling infrastructure especially.
Who knew?
Not a surprise. Because if you're a representative and you have a chance to spend a little bit of money and you want to look good to your constituents, people are telling you they want a bike path, and you say, I'll get you that bike path. And they stick it in the bill and you get a bike path. And so it's a huge opportunity right now for locals, and they should all over the country make sure that their cities and county governments are aware of this opportunity and make sure that those governments are in touch with the representative in the House to get an earmark for the kinds of stuff that we want. I mean, you know, there's a lot of competing projects. So whether or not bike stuff gets funded is going to be dependent upon how much the public pushes for it.
So that brings up a question I didn't even have before, that it never even occurred to me. And that is, how tied in are you as the executive director of CalBike to some of the other state organizations that might not even know about earmarks or haven't looked at them as a possibility for their state? Is there an overarching organization for executive directors of bicycle organizations around the country?
There used to be. Believe it or not, there used to be.
Yeah, it makes sense.
It is now defunct, but we are keeping in touch on our own. Thank you very much. And all the other organizations know about this as well. This is common knowledge. I learn a lot from them. We meet monthly. And I learn a lot from what my counterparts are doing in other states. I'm very grateful.
Yeah, so that sounds interesting to me. You know, that to me would give it sort of this interwoven web effect that, you know, you could see something bigger than whatever tunnel vision everybody has.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for example, now we are following the good example of Delaware, a tiny mm-hmm. little Delaware. Was the first state in 20 years to implement what some people call the Idaho stop,
right,
where you can approach an intersection on a bicycle and keep rolling without stopping if it's safe to do so.
Right. People don't realize when you've already stopped, put your foot down, and then the car stops and waves you through, it's like, you know.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. They don't understand how hard it is to get started again. And we ride.
No, they don't.
And we ride a tandem, so it's even worse.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, in California, you will not have to stop. But, you know, unfortunately, I think that problem that you cited, Diane,
yeah,
isn't necessarily going to get better.
Probably not.
because in that scenario, you're stopping because you don't have the right of way. Right. Like, it's their turn to go, and you're approaching the intersection and you want them to go.
Right.
please go so that I don't have to stop.
Right.
And they sit there and they wait to see if you're going to stop. And if you want to be respectful of the law and of them, you, okay, I'll come to a stop. And then you stop and then they go and you have to get up all that momentum again.
Right.
Or they wave you through, or you assume that they're being gracious and generous and letting you go through, even though it's not your turn, and you wave high and you keep rolling. Right.
Right.
Either of those choices is not great. I wish motorists would just take their turn and go when it's their turn.
Well, and then they complain about the cyclist not being on purpose. I know it's a big conundrum. So we're going to take a left turn because I wanted to talk about e-bikes and how they're fitting into your work and
good.
What you see as, you know, you've got a $10 million e-bike affordability program listed on your site.
Yeah. We think that e-bikes are going to expand the movement for safer streets exponentially. I've seen it with my own eyes. People who don't want to ride a bike because it's too hard, you know, or they don't want to sweat, or they legitimately, you know, can't make it up the hill, suddenly get to ride a bike with an e-bike. And that's massive numbers of people,
right,
over those who currently do it. And every one of those people is going to notice this street is kind of dangerous. I'm not sure that this is okay. And every one of those people is going to join our movement for safer streets. And it's the safer streets that's the crux of the movement. It's safer streets that will make the United States a bicycle-friendly country. You know, Europe was already, you know, certain places in Europe, I should say, were already, you know, pretty bicycle friendly before e-bikes. E-bikes didn't make them bicycle friendly, but and they won't make the United States bicycle friendly either. But it'll increase the constituency for it, and that's going to help a lot.
So, what is the affordability program?
Yeah, so we want to get e-bikes into more people's hands. We are certain that enough people aren't aware of how cool they are and how much easier it makes bicycling. And we are also certain that a lot of people who would hugely benefit from an electric bike can't afford it, cannot afford a good electric bike. You know, good
they're
electric
not cheap.
Bike is like, you know, $2,000 to $4,000. And, you know, if you're a delivery worker for DoorDash or Uber Eats or something, you're not making a lot of money. You know, if you're low income, taking your kids to school, you know, in your beater of a car that you can't afford to replace, but which is expensive to maintain, you're not going to plunk down $2,000, $3,000 for any bike. No way. Right. So we're sure that we can find 10,000 people in California who need help buying an e-bike and get e-bikes in their hands with our $10 million program. The proposal is to make $10 million available to organizations and individuals to provide electric bikes in a way that replaces car trips and supports local bike shops.
And who will fund, or what will fund that program? What are you looking to have funded?
Yeah, there's a couple of opportunities. One is California's general fund, which has a huge surplus this year. And another is the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, which is supported by California's cap and trade auction system to limit how much greenhouse gas emissions companies are allowed to emit.
So, and who actually oversees all those monies?
Variety of agencies, but mostly the California Air Resources Board.
And how friendly are they to this idea of e-bikes for people?
I'm going to say they're friendly, for the record.
Well, that's pretty awesome.
They're way more friendly than they used to be, because they were skeptical that a bicycle, even an electric bicycle, would ever replace enough car miles to make a dent in the greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector.
Did they see a change during COVID when things really slowed down? Besides the fact there were fewer cars on the road, did they see the increase in bicycle ridership?
They did, and I think that that has helped. But more importantly, the data is in now. We've had some researchers study what people do with their e-bikes and how far they travel on them. And the average trip in a survey of North American e-bike users was 9 miles, you know, which is a long trip. Yeah. And 9 miles times 10,000 people times 365 days a year, starts to add up in terms of getting cars off the street.
Right.
So the data is in, and you know, it's hard to refute now. So we know that we're onto something. We know that subsidies also work. A study just this year looked at various incentive programs to kind of figure out how much it's costing us and if it's worth it compared to other kinds of programs as a way to reduce greenhouse gases. And it specifically compared to the programs that we have to help people buy electric cars, and concluded that dollar for dollar, it's more cost effective to help people buy electric bikes. So dollar for dollar, it'd be dumb to not spend money on helping people get electric bikes.
And it's not a huge number relative to an awful lot of other things.
$10 million is nothing. That is nothing. I mean, that, and it's also, I should say, a starting point. We want to have that kind of money. Every year.
So one more time, let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Dave Snyder. He's the executive director of the California Bicycle Coalition. He's clearly in California. The last thing I want to talk about are some of the pressing issues that you see that you are addressing going forward now that things are starting to, quote unquote, get back to kind of normal.
Sure. And I'll talk about what I see as the most important things for your listeners, even though we're not really working on them. And I think that the most important things are preserving the rollback of car space that we created during the pandemic. The open streets, the outdoor dining, the slow streets. Some cities got rid of the push button, beg buttons that you have to press to cross the street. We made a lot of changes that we should have made without a pandemic, and which I think the public has come to see are hugely beneficial for our quality of life. And it is critical that we preserve those spaces. The ability to play a basketball game on the street, you know, on a slow street, is something that we used to have, you know, all over the country. We used to, you know, use our streets to play touch football and basketball and soccer and street hockey and you name it, you know. And over the last several decades, cars have gotten faster, more isolating, and people have gotten more afraid, and we've lost that. If you do that now, people will get mad at you for slowing traffic. And we need to get back to that. And I think that the pandemic showed us what can happen if we use public space differently. It's going to be a challenge, but we're at a pivot point. Specifically around outdoor dining, for example, the opponents of keeping those spaces permanent point out that they're public spaces that we are giving over to a private company or restaurant, and we're not getting anything for it, and we're giving that restaurant an advantage over other restaurants that don't have those spaces. That's a legitimate argument, a legitimate complaint. And our challenge will be to figure out how we can extend those open spaces, that outdoor dining, to more restaurants, and have a system to make sure that it's a fair use of public space, so that we can expand it. We, you know, there's two ways to go if you make that argument. One is, okay, we'll get rid of them all, then that's fair. The other is, this is great, let's figure out how to expand it to more restaurants. And some cities are going to do the former and some are going to do the latter. And the ones that do the latter are going to be a lot more successful.
Well, we do know that economically slowing traffic and giving more, whatever you want to call it, street cred to the street businesses and enterprises is economically beneficial. We do know that. And there's plenty of evidence of that.
The other thing that I want to mention, and this is a very big thought, and I don't have nearly as much to contribute to it as some other leaders in the space of racial justice. But, you know, the killing of George Floyd and the public response to that has awakened an awareness among more people and an anger among people who were plenty aware that is forcing a lot of changes, and we may or may not change, and we're certainly, you know, not going to change fast enough for my preference and lots of people's preferences, but you know, we're going to change how we police, I hope, and that there's an opportunity for organizations that are concerned about traffic safety like ours to play a role in getting police, armed officers, out of the job of enforcing traffic laws, and contributing as a partner in the discussions about how we change how we police in this country so that it's more fair, so that it doesn't end up targeting Black and brown people and poor people. We've made a really minor step in that direction. I'm proud of it. You know, it's one little you know, one very small sliver of the work that's necessary. But with the bicycle safety stop bill that will legalize what people are already doing, it's one less excuse for police to pull somebody over. And another bill that we introduced on the same theory and for the same reasons is, to my mind, even more important and, to my knowledge, unprecedented, and that is a repeal of jaywalking laws in California. We have a bill that will just repeal jaywalking laws straight up. Won't allow you to jump in front of a car, obviously, but, you know, if you are standing on one side of the street and the bus that you have to catch is on the other side, and you know the next bus is in 30 minutes, you're not going to walk down to the corner and wait for the light to change and cross. If you don't have to, you know, you're going to run across the street so you can catch that bus.
Right.
And that's illegal. You know, if there's no traffic around, why should you, you know, have to go to the corner and wait for the light? You know, what happens if you go to the corner and you didn't notice that there was a push button? And you sit there and you wait and you wait and you wait, and the light turns green, but you don't get a walk sign. You still have a don't walk sign. You're legally, you're required to stay there. You can't enter the street because you forgot to push the button, or you didn't even see it. Or by the time you pushed it, it was after the cyclone, it was too late, right? It's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. You should be able to cross the street in those circumstances. And we're going to let people make their own judgments about whether or not they can cross the street without penalizing them if they choose to cross the street when it's otherwise not legal.
What are the chances of that law?
It passed the Transportation Committee.
It did.
I think it stands a pretty good chance, actually.
Well, you know, this has been just a fascinating conversation. I'm really happy to have been able to talk with you. We've been talking with Dave Snyder. He's the executive director of CalBike. If you are interested in knowing more, what about what California is doing? And, you know, we often look to the East Coast and the West Coast here in the Midwest. I mean, I don't consider Cleveland a Midwest town. I consider it more East Coast. But Columbus and Cincinnati are Midwest. So I guess when you look at Ohio, people look at it as Midwest. And we are not as progressive with our ideas often when it comes to transportation. So I'm really happy to have had a chance to talk with you and hope we get to talk again. Will you be attending Sea Otter? Do you go to Sea Otter?
Yeah.
All right.
Wait, do you go to Sea Otter?
Well, I am their podcasting sponsor.
Oh, how about that?
So I'm going to be doing some on-the-ground podcasting at Sea Otter, and so long as they really hold it, yeah, we'll be there. So maybe we can come face-to-face and say
hi. Yeah, our headquarters is in Oakland with offices in Los Angeles and Sacramento. Okay. So it's not too hard to get down there.
Monterey.
Not a very transit-friendly place to go, though.
Yeah, well, I don't have much influence over that. I think they've been going there for, 30 years or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dave, thank you so much for talking with me. This has been
thank
wonderful.
Thank you, Diane. It's been a pleasure.
And I hope you have so much success with all of these fabulous ideas. I really like talking with you.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for your contributions to the global understanding of what we're trying to do.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Appreciate it.
Have a wonderful day.
Bye.
Bye.
My thanks to Dave for joining me on the show this week and for such an enlightening conversation. Clearly dialed in to what is and needs to happen to keep us safe, on California streets at least, I think most any advocacy organization would benefit from some of the work Dave and his team are doing. If you're interested in learning more about the work of CalBike, the programs and initiatives, and any of the other ongoing projects, you can log on to calbike.org. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of The Outspoken Cyclist when we speak with Clarice Lorenzini. She's the only actively competing Asian-American female on the pro triathlon circuit. We'll also have another visit with Ellie Sias, owner of Cycle of Life Adventures, whose touring company is going gangbusters right now. So please join the conversation on our Facebook page. Leave a comment on this or any other episode of The Outspoken Cyclist on our website, outspokencyclist.com. Subscribe to our podcast on your favorite app, and please rate the show, too. One last thing. My thanks to Gary McKeaton for his new voiceovers in our open and close. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.